The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This is Mike Consul with Jeff Dorman. Welcome to the Dorman Report for December 2017, the final Dorman Report of the year. And unless you have been in a very remote country, then you know the big story of the past week has been the first and the largest and tax cut and reform bill since the Reagan years. The Trump administration getting a sorely needed victory right as the year is about to end here. And there are people, Jeff, who say that this is a tax cut and reform bill that has been written by a real estate guy for real estate people.
I don't know that that's 100% the truth, but certainly is a tax bill that appears to be favorable to the real estate industry. That does appear to be something that's going to be true. To a certain extent, I mean, it's good for the commercial real estate business. It may not be so good for the single-family home building business because it actually takes out some of the incentives for home ownership, or at least that's what some folks seem to feel.
So there's that, but there's also it has major implications for the estate tax, which I believe is going to be eliminated. That's a $4 billion benefit to the Trump children alone if Donald Trump was to cash in his chips. By that, I mean enter into immortality after this tax bill goes into effect. So there's that that people talk about. And you were talking just a little bit earlier before we start recording, Jeff, that the rich pay a disproportionate share of taxes for obvious reasons, and they would even if we had a flat tax with zero deductions. But there are people who argue that if we are going to follow economic theory, then a big middle class tax cut with the richest, say 5% or whatever, not getting a tax cut will actually benefit them tremendously, because all that spending that the middle class will then do, and they will spend because an awful lot of them need to spend, ends up buying products that the means of production being owned by the very people who are at the top. So we've got the supply side argument versus the traditional economic theory, and I just don't know of any business or any company that's going to build a new factory and start producing products without demand.
Well, that's probably true. On the other hand, there's trillions of dollars sitting in corporate balance sheets that haven't been invested. And basically what we've done is we've taken and created all kinds of new currency that is drifted onto the balance sheet of financial institutions and onto the balance sheets of corporations. And part of what the tax bill is attempting to do is create some incentives, at least short-term incentives, because they don't last forever, to get some of those dollars invested back into plant and equipment and creating jobs. Whether they will or not, that's going to remain to be seen. And, you know, the interesting thing about any tax bill is none of them are permanent. You know, it depends on what the political climate is as to whether there's going to be continued support for this, or whether, you know, the next administration that comes in will want to reverse some of these trends or adjust the code in some different way. So, but it as you say, the most striking thing about this, the first major tax revision since 1986, that's a long time.
Yes.
And, you know, in terms of whether it favors the rich or doesn't, I've heard both sides of the argument. There was an interesting blog post by Ethan Benner recently, and he says, and I quote, he says, in 2014, the last year for which statistics are available today, the top 1% of American earners took home nearly 20% of all income. but they also paid nearly 40% of all taxes. In that same year, the top 50% of earners paid more than 97% of all taxes, while the bottom 50% paid less than 3%. So his point is, you know, he says, and again, I quote, it goes without saying then, that when there's a tax bill that lowers taxes, that the benefits will accrue disproportionately to those who've actually been paying the taxes. I mean, how can it be otherwise? And I can't disagree with that logic. On the other hand, I personally am going to be impacted because I've got some limitations now on how much interest I can deduct on my mortgage. And if you live in California, you don't need to be in a huge, beautiful, widespread mansion to have $1 million-plus mortgage. And all of us in California who do have those kind of mortgages are going to be severely disadvantaged by, you know, interest limitations, interest deduction limitations. So, you know, you can't have a tax bill that has changes in it that isn't going to disadvantage some people. The question that really comes down to it, is it going to be good overall for the economy? And isn't it be good overall for the real estate investment business and the infrastructure investment business? And everything I've read so far suggests that it might have minor plus impacts to the economy, nothing huge, but it probably will have significant positive impacts to the real estate business in general.
Well, I have a question for you about infrastructure, but before I ask that question, I just want to counter Mr. Penner. His points are well taken, but if Elizabeth Warren was to be sitting across the table from him, or anybody in the middle class would probably say, if I received a larger share of the income, I'd be happy to pay more taxes. It's simply a matter of, you know, you pay a percentage of income. Well, if you have a vast amount of income, you're going to be paying a lot more into the Treasury.
But it seems the country is polarized around two viewpoints. One viewpoint is that there's huge income disparity in the country and that the government should do something to redistribute income in a more equitable and fair manner. The other side of the coin is that there are tremendous incentives in America to try to do well, and those who take the risks and really create value should be handsomely rewarded, and they shouldn't have their income confiscated to redistribute to those who are less successful in being able to do it. Those are the two main polarized viewpoints. There isn't a tremendous amount of room in between for people to have alternative viewpoints, but let me offer one. And that is, in a very wealthy society in which we live, we can afford to be somewhat compassionate. And I think there is some middle ground to be carved out between those two positions. But we do tend to be operating in a very polarized society where people tend to adopt one side or the other and point the thing at the other is that these guys are crazy and greedy, or those guys are communists and socialists. You know, I don't know the answer to the question. I don't know the answer to the debate. It's a debate that's been going on for a long time.
Well, you used the word confiscate, which well represents the position that you were just articulating. You were talking about the two different positions. And that alone tells you just how averse and how angry a lot of people in this country have gotten. And a lot of them are very wealthy people. It's amazing that very wealthy people would be angry about having their money confiscated. One of the points that Barack Obama tried to make when he was president, and I am not a Democrat and I'm not a Republican, I've never belonged to either party. I want to make that clear to our listeners. I've never belonged to either one of those parties and I never will. I have problems with both. But the point that Barack Obama tried to make when he was president is that what allows people to accumulate wealth, it's infrastructure. It's the rule of law. It's a military that protects our borders. And an endless list that if we are not making contributions to that, and the day that wealthy people start to say, my money's actually being confiscated, it's being stolen by the government, rather than I have a government that actually has rules and regulations in place and creates opportunities that make it so that I can accumulate this kind of money, and it wouldn't have been possible otherwise. The fact of the matter is, if being wealthy in this country is too onerous, people can always join the middle class instead, give it all away and join the middle class.
I think you're arguing for one side of the extreme, Michael, and I'm not arguing for either. I'm saying there's a logic to both of them, and I don't want to turn this podcast into a political discussion. The bottom line is, this tax bill has been passed and will be signed into law by the president, like it or not. We're all going to have to learn how to live under it and prosper under it. And there are some good things that are they're good for, you know, less wealthy people. One of them is the lower tax rates for pass-through type owner businesses. And most small businesses that are owned by single proprietors, you know, are operated that way. They're either operated as a sole proprietorship, which is basically all the income is personal income, or they own it in some kind of C corp or LLC or partnership or something of that nature where there's a pass-through. And in the past, they were taxed fully at their highest marginal tax rate that they qualified for on every single extra incremental ounce of income that comes in. And today that's going to be lowered. And that's going to be good for the small business owner. It doesn't do anything for the wage earner. The wage earner's, you know, still, you know, in the same pretty much boat that they were in before, although their, you know, tax rates have been lowered slightly as well. For corporations, a huge boon because the corporate interest rates are being lowered substantially. The theory behind that is that that will create incentives for corporations to earn higher profits and turn those profits back into the economy. So far, that has been the basis for almost every economic stimulus that has come down the pike since the global financial crisis, and it hasn't worked so far. So we'll wait and see whether or not it actually does have those positive benefits. There's also some changes in the tax laws for those corporations that keep a lot of cash offshore to repatriate some of that capital. Again, we'll see whether that's effective or not. May or may not be.
So the history on that is that it's very questionable whether it creates the kind of stimulus that it's supposed to create. But what's very clear is that it does create deficits. And here's the question. It leads to infrastructure. We desperately need an infrastructure program in this country. Donald Trump came into office, and Hillary Clinton promised, if she had won, that there'd be a $1 trillion infrastructure program, which actually doesn't even get us where we need to go. The tax cut was taken care of ahead of that. I'm not sure. I mean, part of the argument was the economy is doing fine. This is not the time for a tax cut because we need that tax cut when the economy corrects, when there's a downturn. Now that ammo has been spent. But in addition to that, now let's get the infrastructure. I agree with you. Let's not keep it political. But the question is just dollars and cents. Is there going to be money left for us to actually have an infrastructure program, which is crucial to the United States continuing to be an economic power?
Well, everybody seems to agree that the current tax bill that's passed and is going to be signed is going to be create a greater deficit. And the proponents of the bill believe that it will create enough economic stimulus to overcome. In other words, if you have more taxable revenue, you'll generate more taxes even at a lower tax rate. That's the theory. Don't know whether that's going to occur or not. That will be interesting to see. It also, if it does, that also could stimulate inflation, which would also cause the government to raise rates. If they're unable to raise revenues through stimulus and increase tax revenues that way, they'll have to finance it. And the only way to finance it is in the Treasury market. And in order to attract more capital, when you have to float another $1 trillion worth of debt, and also, in effect, weaken your credit standing, is to charge higher rates. So most likely this will lead to higher rates. Fed's already said it's going to raise rates 3 times. It may have to raise rates a little higher than that in order to be able to make everything work. And even if the Fed doesn't and holds the lid on it, you know, the Treasury market is an open market. It'll be interesting to see whether, you know, the rates for treasuries have to rise in order to attract the volume of capital we need to finance the deficit moving forward. So those are policy issues. It'll be really interesting to see how they play out.
What do you see, Jeff, in terms of the amount of private investment capital that is ready and looking for infrastructure opportunities? I suppose the positive side of the government being strapped is, and they were strapped before the tax cut, let's be clear about that. But it would force the governments at all levels to look to the private investor, to institutional investors and the various forms of private capital to fund infrastructure projects. Do you think that there is enough, and I realize this is it's elastic based on what opportunities are there, but how much infrastructure-ready money is there in the hands of private investors that could be put to work at this point? Do you have any sense of that?
There's several hundred billion that's been raised, which is a pittance compared to the $4 billion needed to fund the current deficit, estimated deficit in the United States alone, not to mention infrastructure deficits elsewhere around the globe. A lot of that capital is being earmarked for investment outside of the United States because it's so hard to get projects done in the United States. The U.S. Mentality, the citizenry mentality is, my God, they're stealing our assets. And, you know, what they don't understand is they're not stealing assets. They're usually purchasing concession contracts to operate assets for a long period of time. The assets still are held by the entity that created them. Or if they're creating new assets, you know, yes, private holders are creating those assets. If the government isn't capable of financing those assets, we'd be better off having privately financed assets than not having those assets. And the needs are huge. It's roads, it's railroads, it's ports, it's airports, it's water systems, it's wastewater treatment plants, it's the electrical grid and electrical power generation. So there's so many different areas of infrastructure that need, you know, capital, need attention to be able to be revitalized, that you could raise trillions of dollars and still not meet the need. So on the other hand, when there's a lack of capital and a market, typically what will happen is yields will rise to attract the capital. And so that could happen. You could see the yields on infrastructure assets rising. That also means that the cost of using those assets that are passed along to the public will also rise. And there's no free lunch. On the other hand, investing in infrastructure is just that. It's an investment. When the government puts aside, you know, money to invest in infrastructure, it's an investment. It's not an expense. There's a return on an investment. It comes back in the form of increased economic activity, which generates revenues which are taxed. So the best investment the government can make is in things that return on investment. Examples would be infrastructure and education. Both of those provide a huge return on investment. When the government invests in security, you know, military and police services, they're creating a more secure, safe environment for people in which to operate and transact business, which again has a return on investment. So people tend to think of these things as expenditures when in fact they're investments in the future.
I'm glad you make that distinction because so often everything is lumped under the rubric of spending. And, you know, oftentimes what you have to do is just put it right at the kitchen table as I know that's a hackneyed phrase, but, you know, parents who send their children to college, that's an investment. They go out and spend the money instead on a yacht, it's spending. It doesn't mean it's bad spending. But it's spending versus sending children to college works in favor of a family and in favor of our society. Now, let me ask you this. So let's say the United States, let's keep it U.S.-centric for a moment. The United States gets serious about making it easier for public-private partnerships and infrastructure. So they fast track this a bit. That's one of the linchpins in getting more capital applied. What's the second linchpin? Oh, I would imagine the second linchpin is that investors see that the money that's been invested is returning. The yields are very good, and then money starts to rush in where they see that. You know, here's a place where in a yield-starved environment, we can actually make some real returns. What happens under a scenario like that? You would assume then that we would just see more and bigger infrastructure, private infrastructure funds.
Yeah, and I think there's room for there to be more. Many, many pension funds, many life companies, many sovereign wealth funds haven't really made infrastructure investing a priority. And there's a lot of funds still haven't made investments in infrastructure yet. So there's plenty of room for that whole space to grow. It's up to the infrastructure investment management industry to continue to build the case for allocation to the asset class, and that comes in two forms. What are the investment characteristics of the various kinds of infrastructure investment? How do they fit within an institutional portfolio? And then, do you have the goods? You know, can you actually show a track record that shows and demonstrates, without question, that you can actually deliver the kinds of returns that you're promising? And private infrastructure in the United States is a relatively new phenomenon, less than probably 15 years old. And so, at least for institutional investors to participate in it that way. Traditionally, infrastructure in the United States was funded either by the federal government or by the municipal bond market. Both of those entities now are strapped and don't have the capital to allocate. The municipal bond market also is going to be impacted by this because deductibility of municipal bond interest now is going to be subject to tax under the new rules, which could change things. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that could impact all of this stuff, and it's all kind of interrelated. You know, the problem with any complex system is one little grain of sand can have catastrophic effects. And we're really not going to understand fully the implications of the Tax Act that's been put in place until it's actually in place and been working for a while. Then we're going to be able to understand it better.
And I can't let you go, Jeff, without offering some kind of forecast for 2018. Clearly, right at this point, a good economy seems to have gotten better. Under the Trump administration, regulations have been scaled back. It's a very business-friendly environment, and now we've got this tax cut. And businesses and consumers have been pretty optimistic. From what I've heard, the statistics on Christmas shopping have been very good. You talk to our sponsors, our readers, our board members, and so on, and the forecasts that I've seen for 2018 have been pretty positive. But what are you hearing? What do you think are going to be the keys to whether 2018 becomes another strong year, or we start to see some erosion?
Well, there don't seem to be any signs on the horizon that the real estate market is shaking in any way, shape, or form. The thing that typically kills the real estate markets is leverage. And usually when people are starting to get in this state of the cycle, we've had several years where pricing seems to be at all-time highs and cap rates seem to be at all-time lows, one way that people can squeeze additional yield out of the market is to apply leverage, particularly when that leverage is cheap, as it is and continues to be. So when you look at that kind of a scenario, there doesn't seem to be anything inherently baked into the real estate market that would cause a shakedown. Now, people have said, you know, there may be an incentive to borrow more under the new tax law. The problem with that theory is that there's so much regulatory pressure on the lenders that their pocket strings are tied pretty tight. And so it's not that people aren't borrowing today in the real estate business more than they are because they're more prudent. It's because they can't get the money at higher loan-to-values. They can't get the money higher levels than they're currently able to access the markets. It's not that they wouldn't do it if they could. And rates have been low. We know they're going to bump up more over the next year because of the Fed's actions. They could be bid up a little bit more if, the Treasury finds difficulty raising capital and has to raise rates in order to attract that capital, and that everything's priced off the Treasury, so that could move rates up even further. So who knows what's going to happen? It seems to me that all things being equal and all things being on a linear plane, that it looks like smooth sailing ahead. But all things are never equal and all things are never on a linear plane. So we live, as I said earlier, in a complex economy, in a complex climate, and these markets, by the definition themselves, are complex. And complexity is very, very difficult to predict because one tiny change can make a dramatic impact in terms of moving things in an opposite direction. The thing I'd keep my eye on is the stock market. Corporate earnings have been strong, and under the new tax law, they should get stronger. But pricing is pretty high. If the market collapsed in any for any reason, and sometimes for no reason, it could have an adverse impact on allocations to real estate and all alternatives. So we just have to kind of wait and see and play it out. But generally, the prognosis looks to be fair, but who knows? It is always there until it isn't.
Second longest economic recovery in U.S. history. I'm not sure how many months we still have to go before it would make it the longest economic recovery in history. That alone has given a lot of people pause, just wondering, you know, how long can this really last? But although it does seem that in some ways some rules have changed, just at least marginally.
We talk about these markets and the quote cycles in the markets as if we really understand what's going on. And the truth of the matter is, we're not very good at predicting turns in the markets. So if it was as cyclical as everybody says it is, we'd be better at predicting the turns, and we're not. So, you know, again, all we can do is kind of watch for signs. And there are some signs that things are starting to weaken a little bit. I wrote about it in a recent editorial. So,
where do you see the infirmity?
Well, you know, underwriting, for one thing. People are loosening up a little bit in their underwriting. Not a lot, but it always starts with a little. loan-to-values are creeping up a little bit, and people are letting coverage slip a little bit. Not a lot, and not in a meaningful way, but it's one of those signs you want to keep an eye on. Not suggesting Armageddon, not suggesting a turn tomorrow. I'm just saying it's important to keep an eye on these things.
What would you tell our readers, advertisers, sponsors, associates out there, Jeff, as a year-end message?
You know, I would say go out, have a good time, and enjoy this, but be very, very, very careful. As I always say, it's a wacky world out there.